First of all, let me join all the speakers and thank John and Jeremy for giving us this opportunity to come together and celebrate the careers of Stu and Ray. And not just the careers, but also 65 years. That's a hell of a time. Stu, I know from walking into the Chemical Physics Center and being greeted most warmly. Stu is the most warm greeter I've ever met. He is wonderful dinner conversations and wonderful lunch conversations, and thank you, Stu. Ray, my interactions with Ray are best described by Chakotay mediated. Now, Giovanni and Ray and I have had lots of meetings and discussions, and they usually end up with those guys arguing and me taking notes. Ray and I also have a lot of interactions through conferences. I think it's best to say that whenever anybody has a conference on anything to do with mixed quantum classical dynamics, we're always, either you go first and I go, or I go first and you go. So it's crazy like that. Invariably, conferences, you end up at bars. And this is a bar, it was a miserable conference. It was an interesting conference, miserable location. However, this is the bartender indicating where we actually are. This is his bar, and this is Mount Etna in eruption. It wasn't doing it when we were there. Might have been an interesting. However, the next best thing are all these bottles back here, which are all various forms of fire water. And they are in various shades of bright red, and they are extraordinarily alcoholic. After one small glass of this, Ray turned about the same color as the liquid, as you'll see in the next photograph, which is actually over here. Can we turn the lights down just a touch, or maybe we should, because that color is really vibrant. And that has nothing to do with the quantity of wine that Ray has drunk. And you can see that rosy color to his cheeks right there. And of course, this generally tends to, great. Yeah, that's even better. Look at that. Ray is, looks like the cat that ate the canary right here. Very, very happy with himself. And when Ray gets into that type of mode, he's very, very apt to be, explains things. He becomes conversational, and this is my wife back here. And at this point, Ray decided that he was in the middle of working with these ideas of surface hopping. Okay, and so this is actually a shot of Ray explaining surface hopping, mixed quantum classical surface hopping. And you see him doing this little jig here right there to my wife. So this is mixed quantum classical surface hopping, the simplest way that Ray could find to explain it, on the caldera of Mount Etna. And I don't know where the other surface is, so this is like a hop that has not been successful. So as I said, Giovanni, of course, mediates a lot of these interactions, and these gentlemen here are also very... This is the... we mean business and take no prisoners stance. Okay, this is really what it's all about. And so this is also on Sicily. Okay, so that's the introductory. Thank you for all of the fun times. Part of the talk. Now let's get down to business. As I said, we're going to be looking at mixed quantum classical methods used to describe electronic and vibrational pure dephasing and dissipation in condensed phase systems. This is me. This is a postdoc from Giovanni's group, student from my group and postdoc from my group, who's now a postdoc with Giovanni. These are various students, Zunghua and Lena and Emily, funding from these folks here. Okay, so this is the experiment. This is actually a remark. I love this stuff. Okay, this is actually real quantum mechanics in action, and you can see it. So this is an experiment from a couple of years ago now, doing time-resolved coherent anti-Stokes Raman spectroscopy. We were basically, you toss every laser you can find into a sample, and this is it here. And you do it with exquisite timing. Okay, so basically what happens here is taking the molecule in its ground state, pumping it up to an excited electronic state with one color. So this would be the green color, then hitting it a small time later and dropping it back down into the ground state so that you actually produce two different states, a coherent superposition of two quantum states, a vibration of the molecule, okay? And those vibrational quantum states are now interacting with the environment, okay? And basically what happens is you can actually read out the interference pattern. And this interference pattern that you've produced, okay, because you've produced this coherent superposition, if it wasn't in an environment, it would live forever. But, of course, it's in an environment. And the way you read out this this interference pattern is by, again, putting in another pulse from your laser up to, and taking the thing up to the excited electronic state, and then watching for fluorescence, because if the two wave packets are in the same point at the same time, there'll be a strength quantum factor, and you'll drop back down again, so you'll see a signal. And so this is actually the signal that you see, and so this is actually a readout of the real interference pattern between these two vibrational packets that have been produced in the environment, or in the molecule interacting with the environment. As you can see, it dephases. It drops down like this, and so we can understand why that happens, and it's a very beautiful realization of a quantum mechanical entanglement. Okay, so basically what we do is we produce a superposition of two quantum vibrational states here by putting in these two pump and dump pulses, if you want to call them those. And the environment doesn't know anything about what's just happened, so it sits there in this state. So this is our initial state that we prepared. Then the system evolves, and as it evolves, of course, if I've got one vibrational state, state I, pushing on the environment, it pushes in a different way and to state J, and so you get a superposition of different environmental states, and that's the entanglement between the two quantum subsystem and the environment. And of course, what this envelope is looking at is tracing out over all the bath, right? Because we're only monitoring the system, tracing out over the bath, forming a reduced density matrix. And looking at it looking at the different components of it. So the different components, as you can see, have this overlap between the Bath wave functions. And so these are these many-body Bath wave functions that are evolving in the presence of two different vibrational states. As you can see, I can do this experiment in whatever surface I like. This is the lowest energy state of the molecule, electronic state of the molecule, down here. I can do it by putting in two pulses that take me up instead of one up and one down, and then I can produce a vibrational coherence in the excited electronic state and try and understand how an excited electronic coherence differs from an excited vibrational coherence differs from a ground state vibrational coherence. This is the picture of what you see. The frequency is a little bit different. That's just because you've produced the different components different vibrational components. Separated by closer energies. The remarkable thing, and you'll understand why this is in a second, the remarkable thing is it lives about the same time. So this is a couple of hundred femtoseconds, a couple of thousand femtoseconds, 2 picoseconds on this time scale. So it lives about half as long, or maybe a quarter as long, as the vibrational coherence in the ground state. Let's try and understand that. Why that's a surprise. Well, the reason it's a surprise is if you look at molecules, these are very simple molecules in either liquids or solids. If I look at the experiments I showed you earlier, we're looking at a molecule and a solid, you see an enormous amount of energy dissipation, okay, in the very first vibrational extension, right? So in the ground state, when you take the molecule up and put it back down, the ground state has a tiny little bond length, okay? When you put it into an excited state, of course, it's an enormous expansion of the bond, okay? So it goes out, it hits the solvent wall. In one vibrational collision, okay, you drop 2,000 wave, that's a chemistry unit, okay, you dropped about 20 quanta of energy. So you dump an enormous, this is a highly nonlinear, highly non-perturbative situation of dumping an enormous amount of vibrational energy into the environment very, very quickly within one vibration. So why you should expect coherent motion, okay, why you should expect this coherent evolution of the wave packet, okay, this is not this is the quantum interference signal that you're measuring, okay? Why you should expect this the reason you should expect this, in fact, is that it means that, you know, my molecule has come out, it's hit the solvent wall, that's in one vibrational state. My molecule has come out, it's hit the solvent wall in a different vibrational state. These two vibrational superposition of environment states, okay, is now evolving. And let's take a look at a little cartoon of what actually is going on there. And this is the kind of thing. So one molecule, or one part of the superposition is a short molecule. Another part is a very long molecule. One is not pushing the bond, pushing the surroundings much at all. The other is pushing the surroundings a lot. You've produced this entanglement. This is a real macroscopic. You can actually almost see it. It's a few hundred atoms. It's a Schrodinger cat. Okay, so this is a vibrational Schrodinger cat state where your solvent environment has been put into this state, and so the modes that are excited in the environment, okay, must be moving in such a way as to still preserve the coherence. So even though you've dumped an enormous amount of energy, the vibrational coherence, the quantum coherence of the mixture of states that you've produced, is still there. There's another thing to keep in mind here, and that is what's also happening, of course, is that there are other contributions, and that's that little line that comes in there. When you get to an excited electronic state, there are also other excited electronic states that cross each other. There's a congestion of electronic excited states. And, of course, this leads to not only vibrational relaxation, but also electronic relaxation as you dump energy into different electronic states, or you rearrange the electronic energy in the system. Okay, so it's a very complex phenomenon, and we want to be able to study it and simulate it. And what it involves is lots of atoms, okay, that are moving in concert with an excited molecule, a molecule in a superposition of states, and we want to be able to describe that. So I'm going to show you a very simple explanation in the next few slides with a bunch of equations. Tom Shirakawa earlier gave us a similar type of model. I'm going to use the model in a different context here to justify an approximation. So this is the system little bath, big bath model Hamiltonian. Here I've got my system, that little vibrator. I've got my bath. That will be now so this is the vibrational state of the system, of the vibrator. My bath will be the local atoms that are closest to the vibrator, okay? And my big bath will be the atoms further out. So they're kind of screened from the quantum dynamics that's going on by the intervening, little bath, okay? And there's a big bath, little bath coupling. We're going to the model now is to put the system into a superposition state, okay? Prepare the environment. The environment doesn't know that the superposition state has been prepared, so that may as well be in its in some sort of ground state or some sort of thermal distribution. I'm going to assume that I can write that as a product of two bath densities. And now I'm going to evolve the density matrix. And so I will have a bra and a ket that will evolve forward and backward. So this is the sort of thing that I will start the system out in and then move it around. My reduced density matrix, it'll have this decay, this exponential decay, and I want to be able to calculate this. So this is the way we're going to do this. So we're going to monitor, if I take the absolute value of this, that's going to give me the overall decay of those curves, and we're going to be able to calculate these vibrational dephasing and electronic and all other types of behavior in this way. So I have these two propagators, one moving this way, one moving this way, and they have big bar, they have quantum numbers for the vibration, they have local coupled modes, little guys here, the little bath, and then they have an environment that's coupled to the little bath. Y2 bath operators? You're going to see in a second, okay? I've got a bath. That is the local bath that's coupled directly to the quantum system. Then I've got a bath. Then that bath is coupled to the environment, surrounding environment. So this bath here. Oh, let me put the Hamiltonian up on the top. So this is your Hamiltonian. This is your little vibrator. This is your local bath. Okay. So this would be all the atoms around the vibrator. And this is the system bath coupling. Okay. And then I've got that bath coupled to a surrounding bath. Okay, so this is a bunch of harmonic oscillators bilineally coupled, for example, to my local bath. Okay, local bath, global bath. You'll see in a second. Okay. Okay, if I take this expression, this is my Hamiltonian, this is various matrix elements, this is now the matrix elements in the vibrational basis, okay, the different vibrational states, so I need to get these guys. These will cause, the off-diagonal elements in here will actually cause the vibrational energy relaxation associated with that highly non-perturbative relaxation we saw earlier. If we're interested in pure dephasing, I don't have any of those types of transitions, okay, so this is just looking at the lowest, just at the pure dephasing component. Here, I can set these guys to zero and just consider the pure vibrational dephasing. This is an unnecessary approximation, I'll fix it later, okay? Under those circumstances, each of these propagators has this form where I have an integration over the local bath and the big bath, the further afield stuff, and I have to do these various different path integrals. Okay, now I've assumed a very nice form. Okay, so I've my local environment. Okay, has this full dimensional potential, whatever it is. My environment that's surrounding the system. Okay. Is bilinearly coupled to this harmonic bath. I need a lattice for this description. I need a lattice for this rigor, this level of rigor, exactly. Yeah. In principle, however, you can get away with harmonic descriptions of quite irregular systems, fluids. That's true. So the notion here is indeed that this dephasing process occurs quickly enough so that there's no exchange from the little bath to the big bath, certainly. Yeah. Okay, so now, of course, what I can do, I can integrate out the big bath variables rather trivially, as has been shown to us many times by many different people. Feynman influence functionals. I can basically come in here and compute this quantity, so this is now my reduced density matrix. I have forward and backward actions. These are my actions, and I have this this local bath. Path-dependent influence functional, and it has some very pretty properties. Here's the expression for it. In the situation where I've got this bilinear coupling, it has this nice form that's been used by all these people. And the point here is that there is a real part and a complex part. This real part has a kernel that is temperature-dependent. The imaginary part is not temperature dependent for this harmonic environment model. And moreover, if you go away and analyze this this real part, you find it has some very nice properties. If I just basically stuff in a simple ohmic spectral density, and I can do others, but this is the simplest one to see. If I stuff in an ohmic spectral density here for the product of rho and C, you can easily obtain the high temperature limit of this thing. You can also obtain the low temperature limit of this thing. And what you find, of course, is that depending on what omega C is, this quantity becomes local in time, either in the high temperature limit or the low temperature limit, depending on the magnitude of omega C. That means that now this influence functional, this part of it, of course, is a real exponential. And if this is local in time, as I've just indicated, you find that for these limits, then essentially this influence functional will be nothing more than this integral of this Gaussian form, and which basically in appropriate limits of strong friction and high cutoff frequency, for example, or strong friction in the high temperature limit, it'll be dominated by the situation where the forward and backward paths, the propagation of each of the two different propagators appearing here, are dominated by this the proximity of these two parts. So that's the approximation I'm going to. So in other words, all I used that big bath for was to localize my little bath variables around the forward equals backward path. Okay, and I'm going to proceed now and expand in the difference between forward and backward paths of the little variables, just using the bath as the big bath as something that A localizes me in time, and B localizes me in this spatial variable. So in other words, the effect of the big bath coupling is to localize the bath path around forward equals backwards, and then I'll do the and then we'll see in a second how I can linearize this in the path difference. There's a switch of notation. Now my big bath variables are all gone. I've used them to produce this, essentially removed the interference between the forward and backward paths of the environment. And my solvent coordinates now will be these Q variables solvating the quantum subsystem states and what follows. So this is the expression. So now I've just got my little bath, which is this Q here, and here are my quantum states. Now we're going to do the full Hamiltonian, where I allow for quantum transitions between all the states. This is a typical type of quantity we might be interested in, a correlation function. I'm interested in something much more simple when I'm looking at the, but can be written in this same type of form when I'm looking at the reduced density matrix in its evolution. Here I've got some operator some initial density propagators, and so this is a diagrammatic representation of the paths involved. These are real-time paths. These are imaginary time paths. These are different measurements that are taking place. And, of course, what I just showed you was that if this coordinate is coupled to a bath appropriately with a high enough cutoff frequency and appropriate friction, the forward-backward paths will of the local environment will coalesce onto each other, or be only dominated by small displacements. I'm going to use a way to actually write that Hamiltonian, which helps. It gets rid of the state labels, and so my Hamiltonian now is going to be written out for my quantum subsystem is going to be written out in terms of these so-called mapping variables. This is also known as bosonization. Essentially, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have these mapping variables describe creation annihilation operators. And transfer operators here for the quantum subsystem. And what this Hamiltonian now looks like is it has arbitrary little bath or bath variable dependence on these coefficients, but it has quadratic dependence on these variables here. And as such, I can use semiclassical methods to actually propagate this Hamiltonian exactly. Propagate the quadratic part of the Hamiltonian exactly. So this is the transition amplitude that I'm interested in now. I'm interested in taking my system from one state to another state as the local environment varies along some path. This is a phase-based path integral description of the quantity I'm after. And of course, I've got two of those. The point about this is I can write each of these transition amplitudes now as in terms of polar representation. I can identify a phase. The phase actually is intriguing because the phase will have these variables here which represent my quantum transition. Okay, these are the quantum transition variables, and in terms of and matrix elements that describe how the transition is going to take place. So the final expression, or the near final expression you get, this is actually still an exact expression at this point. What I'm going to do now is take this expression and approximate it by using the assumption that the environment will decohere the interference between the forward and backward paths, as I described earlier, the big bath environment, making these two coalesce and then expanding in terms of the difference between the forward and backward paths. Okay, these are phase-based classes I mentioned earlier. So essentially, when you do that, what you get is this. Okay, so here's and it has a lot of things that are very familiar and expected, and they actually look a lot like the sorts of things that the methods that Ray and Giovanni, the mixed quantum classical approaches, you see. Okay, so essentially what we've got then is a Wigner transform of the density operator projected onto the state space. That provides our initial conditions for the mean paths. Then we measure something or other at the end of the trajectory, another matrix element of whatever this is. And I have various phase factors. The important, there is a zeroth order term, which is actually the difference in phase along the path between one potential and another potential, so labeled by two different labels here. These are quantum states. And what's more, I get a classical dynamics, not surprising, as I truncated it linear order. Essentially, my dP/dt is a force, and my momentum is appropriately defined. And now I've got an explicit expression for the actual force. This is not a surface hopping-like force, okay? It's a force that mutates as a result of the dynamics of these quantum subsystem variables. These are the things that that represent the creation annihilation operators that we introduced earlier to describe how the system transfers from one state to another. And so what you see is if there's no off diagonal elements, okay, I actually end up suggesting that if I'm going to run dynamics, I should be moving on the mean, the arithmetic mean of two potential energy surfaces, okay, and averaging these various different quantities over trajectories that move not on one surface but on some mean of two surfaces, two quantum subsystem surfaces. I have to average phase factors when I do this over some distribution, quantum mechanical Wigner transform, that's this thing up here. My force, if I've got an off-diagonal contribution, as my trajectory is moving, and these variables are being integrated, these are the quantum subsystem variables, I will mix in off-diagonal terms. So essentially what you get is a picture that looks like this. You have a single mean path that the heavy variables are following, the RP, and the quantum subsystem variables are being integrated, both along the two amplitude factors are being integrated along this path, and you're carrying pairs of amplitudes that you actually use to compute the forces at any point along this. So it looks like a continuously mutating potential field as it goes. Okay, so here's a simple model problem now to describe, to explore how this might work. This is one of the famous Tully canon problems. You essentially set up some initial Gaussian on this side, for example. You toss this into this region where the off-diagonal element turns on, and as that happens, you'll be running on various different contributions. If I start the system out like this in some pure state, I can then run trajectories up from here, and they'll run over to here, and I have to add up all the different contributions from different trajectories that end in different states. So my force is determined by the states that I'm going to. I have to average phase factors, as I mentioned, and I have to compute these types of quantities. Here are some results for this. This is in the situation where I've got no big bath, okay, so I just take this. Now I can actually, if I take this problem and I couple it to a bunch of harmonic oscillators, I can actually do that. It's not analytic. There are very nice methods that are now available, these so-called multi-configuration time-dependent Hartree techniques, and I can actually take this problem and couple it to up to 20 bath modes, so 20 oscillators out there in the bath, and calculate the result exactly. If there's no bath, no big bath coupled to the system, this is the quality of the results you get. So this is looking at the probability of that I'm on state one. This is looking at the probability that I'm on state two as a function of momentum. So I'm changing the wave packet momentum into this coupling region. It does a great job here. It does an okay job here, but not spectacular. If I now couple this system to a bath, okay, and study it and calculate the exact results with MCTDH, I get pretty, this is now, for some particular cutoff frequency and for some friction, I get a considerably improved result. We're still playing with these parameters to demonstrate that this is actually, including the big bath, is actually making this linearization approximation more and more reliable. Okay, so we could use it to do everybody's favorite private condensed phase model problem, the spin boson. This is actually looking at exact path integral results that Nancy Macri and co did for two levels coupled to a bath of harmonic oscillators, and comparing it with the solid line, which is our forward backward approximate approach. We call it land map because it sounded like a good idea. Land map, you know, it's got that catchy acronym. Linear, and it stands for, I can't even remember what it stands for. That's the problem with acronyms. You never remember what they stand for. So anyway, linearized approach to non-adiabatic dynamics using the mapping Hamiltonian is what it stands for. So this is actually looking at a coherent regime where my temperature is low, and my friction is my Kondo parameter is appropriate for this type of behavior. As I increase the Kondo parameter appropriately, or increase the temperature appropriately, I get an incoherent regime. And our calculations of the solid lines and the dots are the results of path integral calculations. So we do a pretty good job over a wide range of parameters for that problem, as well as for the nonlinear problem I showed you earlier. And the point here is we don't need too many trajectories. If you do real calculations on these things, these take forever to do, millions, billions of trajectories, 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 7th type, if you're doing a semi-classical description. The calculations using MCTDH, the exact results, are enormously expensive calculations, even with, this is with 20 modes here. And our results, a few hundred trajectories can capture these types of dynamics. Okay, so now let's use this. One more point that I have to make here, that the initial distribution that I described there was a bunch of harmonic oscillators in their thermal distributions. That's easy to do. I need to be able to Wigner transform these initial density operators and compute those quantities, and that's non-trivial. The approach we use, I'm not going to spend any time on because I don't think I have enough time to do it. It basically involves using this approach that is described in the next few slides, which I'm not going to talk about. It involves using an idea from Feynman and Kleiner, which essentially says variationally use the Gibbs-Bogdanov variational principle to adjust the free local curvature and offset of an effective harmonic approximation to your potential, and then you can analytically Wigner transform. And that actually works, surprisingly, even for liquids. Okay, so even for liquids, you can actually compute Wigner transforms via this approach and get decent results. Okay, so that's the actual result. So this is so we actually sample the Boltzmann operator for the environment. So that's the only quantum part of the environment, the only way it's described quantum mechanically is initially via a sampling of the Wigner phase space density for the environment. And then and subsequently it follows these classical like trajectories on various different linear combinations of the surfaces that I've described. Okay, the problem we're going to study, as I mentioned, is this vibrational relaxation problem. I'm going to do this problem now. I showed you I can do it for the non-adiabatic case where I allow transitions. Now I'm going to look at just the dephasing. This is a very simple model where I basically take a small bond and a long bond, and I stick it into the solvent, and I compute the interactions with the environment just by computing it for different bond lengths. So that's the approximation. That's just a grid-like approximation for the state. You need to worry about the rotation of the molecule as well, but that's relatively straightforward. This is now looking at the density matrix computed for 0 to n. Okay, so these are different vibrational levels as a function of time. This is looking at its decay. And what I'm doing here, of course, is I'm exciting the molecule to different levels. So I'm actually producing the linear combination. And as it's being excited, the environment is actually interacting with it in different ways. And so the decay here is actually our T2, our pure dephasing time. And this is the way we calculate it, as I mentioned. So our initial density can be sampled in different ways. We're going to explore that in 1 second. Then I run my trajectories. These trajectories now move with this force. This is just the mean force. And I evaluate the average of essentially the energy gap. It turns out to be what that phase factor is. And I compute that as a function of state number. And this is actually a comparison between classical results, experimental results. As I showed you at the beginning, these times for different ways of preparing, all they have to do is tune their lasers in different ways to produce different initial linear combinations of vibrational states, and then they can extract these dephasing times from that envelope I showed you. So this is looking at I2 in krypton, a very simple molecular system, at various different temperatures. This is the experimental results you see here. This is actually using classical initial conditions. So of course, if I use a classical density operator here, I have very strongly structured. This is just a pair distribution function at 2.6 k And it's very strongly structured. If I do the Feynman-Kleinert sampling and put in the actual Wigner transform and the quantum initial distribution of the environment reliably, and then all I do essentially in this calculation is run it on the mean of the two potential surfaces. So if I treat it classically, I get way too slow growth with quantum, way too slow vibrational vibrational dephasing. If I actually use the Wigner initial condition, I get this behavior here for my broadened pair distribution function, and my dephasing, not surprisingly, is much faster and in reasonably good agreement with these experimental results. At high temperatures, of course, my lattice at 20K, the Wigner transform of the density is very well approximated. This is actually at 32K. Is very well approximated by the classical initial distribution, and so I get great results even with classical mechanics. So it's only very at low temperatures where this dephasing, but it's a huge effect, right? There's a factor of 5 difference in the dephasing rate across most of these quantum numbers. Okay, so that's showing you that this method can be applied to very large systems and can yield really quite good results. The only thing we use here is simple vibrational potentials determined from gas phase. And interactions determined from standard potential type methods, and then running this dynamics. Okay, so this is actually looking at the dephasing. We're as you add more and more trajectories, of course, you get this dephasing, and this is the way we calculate the thing. We can also look at preparing. At the initial electronic dephasing, okay? So in other words, I can prepare a molecule down here in its ground state, I can prepare a molecule up here in its ground vibrational state, and then I can run a trajectory on the mean of those two surfaces. They're fundamentally very, very different in this particular case because the potentials are displaced from one another, so the electronic dephasing is very, very fast, and that's often an assumption for such potentials compared to the vibrational dephasing. And that's not the case, of course, if the potentials move on top of one another. Let me summarize now. Basically, what I've shown you is that this linearized mixed quantum classical trajectory description, where I have little bath where I use my little bath variables, I can get that description, that linearization approximation, to be reliable. I showed you that would become reliable when the environment had certain when the global environment had certain properties, localizing the influence functional in time and in space. And essentially, in other words, what that did was that made the condensed phase environment really a friend instead of a foe as far as trying to do quantum calculations are concerned, because it essentially said, I only need to worry about small displacements in forward and backward paths, because as soon as my paths of forward and backward get far enough away, the influence functional term will kill them. We are currently attempting to take this method and use it as a short time approximation. At short times, of course, the pads will be close and remain close for short enough times. And so if I can use it as a short time approximation, I can then build a surface hopping like approach from this procedure. And these students are currently looking at that. On that front, I'd like to thank you all, and thank you, Ray. Thank you.